ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys, Corbin Middlemass and Ed Cowan, for your Friday, the eve of whatever this game is, what are we calling it?
Challenger,
which is about to start in the BBL tonight, of course. The little prelude into the final, which is coming up on Sunday in Perth. My name's Corbin Middlemass. I'm in Melbourne, the home of the Grand Slam of the Asia Pacific, which I'm well aware of at the moment. And my podcast co-host is in Sydney, Ed Cowan. Hello, Teddy.
Corb, I've been taking cricket notes this week because you have been working around the clock. Give our joyful listeners a sense of your days at the moment, so they can appreciate the effort it is to drag you into the studio at 1 o'clock on a Friday.
My body clock, I had a day off the other day and I cannot get to sleep before like 2 or 3 in the morning. I cannot wake up before 10 o'clock. So I'm on the night shift at the Australian Open. And so on my day off, it's like 11:30 p.m. and my eyes are like wide open. I feel like I'm on Rod Laver Arena and I'm there sort of broadcasting tennis. So doing all the night sessions, which is, I mean, it's a big time event. I mean, it's not the sport closest to my heart, but it's, this time of the year in particular, to be part of a major event's awesome and being able to cover that. We do have a sneaky TV in the back of the box. So when there was about 2 overs to go in the Stars Hurricanes game the other night, I was perfectly had it manoeuvred that I was off air at that particular time and I was watching the last 2 overs of the cricket. So I feel like I've seen enough that I can get through in this. I feel like there's some hot topics in the cricket world. There's a bit kicking around.
We've got a bit to get through. I'm glad that you're off air at the time because I know you're a good multitasker, but commentating live tennis while watching a game of Big Bash would have taken it to next levels. My appreciation for your skill is high, but that would have been absolutely all time.
Just some shout outs off the top. Ran into Patrick, who is a listener of the podcast, sort of let me know that he tunes in, which I must admit I was very envious of Patrick as I was walking into work and he was standing outside Rod Laver Arena waiting for a group of mates, beer in hand, and ready to have a great day at the tennis and be in and around Melbourne Park. I thought, damn, maybe I could just call in sick and go and hang out with Patrick and his mates and enjoy a nice night at the tennis. But shout out to him. It was nice to hear from one of our listeners, Teddy. We always get a kick out of when we run into people out and about.
We do, absolutely. And we got a lovely feedback email from Roger as well, who's having a tricky time of it at the moment, but just acknowledging how much he loves the pod and how it's helped him on his road to recovery. So it's awesome. Makes it this public service podcast all the more worthwhile. Corb.
100% here. Shout out to Roger. The BBL, Teddy, we're down to 3. So the Scorchers are through to yet another final. It's an incredible record. So 9th time they've made the final. We're only in the 15th edition of the tournament, aiming to try and win title number 6. More on them in just a moment, but it does set up the Sixers hosting the Hurricanes tonight. And the reason for that is that the Hurricanes were able to get through against the Melbourne Stars. Now, one man who will not be there tonight is Bubba Azam. And I feel like that is the place to start. Mark Waugh said on the television coverage the other night that the Sixers need to show some tough love and drop him from the lineup ahead of a must-win cutthroat challenger match against the Hurricanes tonight. And we've since learned that he's not going to be there, and it's not because of his omission from the team. He will return to Pakistan to, in inverted commas, commence preparations for the upcoming international matches. Now, Pakistan are yet to name their team for the T20 World Cup. They play a 3-game series against Australia starting on January 29, which is 6 days from today. It is also 4 days after the final. Now, he was dropped from the national team last year due to a sluggish strike rate, which we've obviously seen continue throughout the tournament. Here in the BBL, he also missed selection in the Asia Cup, but he's out of here. The $420,000 player on the platinum contract and leading run scorer in T20 international history. Am I taking this completely on face value, Teddy, or am I waiting for the other shoe to drop?
Well, it depends what shoe you're wearing, Corb. I mean, so I will say I have no preparatory knowledge here, aside from playing 20 years of professional cricket. And I'll give the lens of every cricketer around the world what they would be saying is this is only ever player-driven. So the player picks up the phone, calls the PCB or any national body and says, I want to come home. I have a feeling I'm going to get dropped. Or maybe they've told him he's going to get dropped and I need to save some face here. Can you please recall me and put in whatever press release you wish, insert comments, And so everyone gets a win out of this. I'd call it a bit of a free hit for the Sixers, I think. I have no idea what was happening on and around the selection table, but you can't imagine that the Bubba Azam name wasn't coming up as, geez, this is a really tricky situation. And that, forget the money, where he's probably not in our best team. He's out of form. He's fielding poorly. And so we probably need to have a conversation. So even before that came up, I think Bubba saw the writing was on the wall and called the PCB. That's my take. I don't know if it's accurate or not, but that's my kind of read through. So I think it's a win-win for everyone is where I kind of get to.
It's a sad way for the relationship to end, though, isn't it? That you think this is a guy towards the end of his career. He's, as I said, all-time leading run scorer in T20 international cricket. The guy's an absolute, modern-day great. And yet, I think the most memorable part of his stay is going to be his, disagreement with Steve Smith and the way that he exited the ground in what's going to be the last time that he bats at the SCG. So, pretty sad way for it to end as a guy that was really sold as, one of the pin-up boys, and come see him play at the start of the tournament. That basically he's going home before the two biggest games, and no one seems to be too disappointed about it.
No, I think you're right. A few things come to mind. One is I think his star has been fading for some time, and when people get dropped from their national team, and particularly someone with a track record historically like Bubba, you can kind of get a sense that things aren't moving in the right direction. So you could say it was a poor signing, particularly at that price. And who else was available? Who knows? That goes to the talent pool, that is available to the Big Bash, separate point altogether. But there's a secondary consideration for the Big Bash, and that is commercial value, bums on seats slash TV audience.
Yep.
And in many respects, you could say he did do his job. There were those Facebook or social media stats that were put through the moment he signed, and the Sixers all of a sudden went from zero to hero on social media, for instance. The ticket sales have been close, if not record breaking. And so there's an argument to say it was a good signing.
Yeah.
And all that has been achieved without having to play him in a game that, decides whether you're going to play in the final or not.
Yeah, and also some of the content. I don't know if you've seen, like, on Pakistan cricket Twitter and stuff like that. There's been these AI generated images which show Bubba in the dressing room with Steve Smith and Mitchell
That
Starc,
is
and some of that
so funny.
context, some of that content
Such
has been
great content.
elite. So
Bubba in tears and Steve Smith consulting.
I have enjoyed some of all that kind of stuff, and then and sort of you think, oh no, that's very much a deep fake. There's a sixth finger or whatever it turns out to be. 11 matches he's played in the tournament, 202 runs at 22. Only three sixes for the tournament. And I saw Nick Savage tweet yesterday, there have been 350 occurrences of a cricketer scoring 200-plus runs in the BBL in a single season. Of those 350, Bubba Azam's strike rate of 103 is the slowest. So that's a 15-year tournament.
Honestly, I do watch him bat and think, I'd fancy my chances. I was a very, very average T20 cricketer, but I would have loved the opportunity to play 11 games straight, opening the batting with two fielders out consistently. And you'd expect at least to strike, opening the batting at least, even if you're not going particularly well at 120. And it kind of speaks to the Sixers' style has been, probably a little bit not archaic, but probably old school and old fashioned, and speaks to the T20 games of 10 to 15 years ago. And I think this gives them an opportunity to break the shackles. You can kind of imagine a situation tonight where Moses probably opens the batting and Jordan Silk comes into the middle order. So you've now got a better fielding team, you've got a better batting team, and the team all of a sudden looks a lot more dynamic, particularly at the top of the order.
Great. There's plenty of dynamism in that lineup. The 15th edition of the tournament, as we said, now the Sixers have to play in this repechage. I like what you said there, by the way, actually. That it almost reminds me of how, like, Australia used to play their T20 cricket. Like, it was, let's try and win with the ball and grind out as many as we can with the bat. But, we're obviously, the national team's a fair way from that now. So I want to just give the Scorchers their shine that they deserve here ahead of what's going to be a final. I mentioned the numbers off the top. Ninth time they've made the final. That's an incredible strike rate, and so many times where you felt like, yeah, this team's done. Remember they had the run at the start where they were the runners up in the first two seasons, then won, you know, three titles in the space of four seasons, and then it felt like they were gone again. And this is where I really want to give Adam Voges his flowers, who's been the most successful coach that WA cricket has ever seen. I mean, it's undeniable in the numbers that he's put up, chasing his 10th title here, and yet he's almost been able to sort of reinvent this team twice, where they had a bit of a lull, and he copped a lot of criticism for that when he first took over, won a couple of titles, and then even, yeah, you weren't the only one leading into this season, people saying, oh, I'm not sure if their star's fading, if they're still, you know, capable of being the team they once were. And he's got them back there again. It's been an incredible journey for this franchise over the, you know, decade and a half this competition's been running.
Yeah, and the key point there is he's done it differently each time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you saw the team that he inherited, great defensive bowling lineup, some good options with the bat, but not, you know, not the youthful exuberance that we now see. And if you flip that over and you're looking at this team of the last two seasons, you say, oh, geez, I've lost a lot of bowling experience. Well, he was willing to take a long-term view on some high-quality talent, and Cooper Connolly's a case in point here, but there are others. You know, he recruited international players with low egos who are willing to play a role in the middle order, for instance, and really suit what they needed, not necessarily a big brand name, but someone who could fit the program. And then it's actually turned itself on its head. So they've now got an attacking batting lineup with some skill with the ball. We don't look at that bowling attack.
No.
They've found a way with the ball and they dominate with the bat on a wicket that hasn't actually been that conducive to high scores. So, as I said, it's more the how than the outcome.
Yeah.
It shows incredible flexibility in thinking from a young coach to shape a team and a squad and a program and a style of play over time. And, you know, as you said, give him his flowers, but there aren't too many coaches who are willing to do that. They kind of have their lane.
Yep.
This is my coaching philosophy. This is how we're going to go about it. And yet we've seen Adam Voges be incredibly fluid in his approach. And so that's pretty incredible in its own right.
Like 100%. And it's amazing what happens. You know, you win games, people will come. You don't necessarily need the brand name player or whatever it turns out to be. And it's been an incredible track record. I also think, and again, I know again it feels like we're discounting the Scorchers, and even when I'm giving them the flowers, I'm talking them down. But I think if you were to line up the championship team from all 15 years of the Big Bash, I don't think the championship team this year is going to be in your top five or six. Like, I actually think there's been stronger teams in recent years. But what they've got might just be better than everyone else. Like, and that's sort of what it's proven so far, that they're going to start a substantial favourite, you think, no matter who they play in Sunday's final. So credit to them. That's all they got to be. They got to be better than everyone else. They don't have to be the best 11 the competition's ever seen.
Yeah, and they've got two strong competitive advantages. One is they have, more than any other place, a home ground advantage.
Correct.
You know, a consistent wicket, but a wicket that's very different to other places around, and they are the best at playing there. And also a cultural thread that even though their style of play is different, they believe that they can win, and those players have been able to integrate that thread right through this new style of play. So they're two pretty powerful things to come up against, and you'd expect them to win on Sunday.
Yeah. Ashton Turner has a chance to become the first three-time title-winning captain in the history of the BBL. They'll play either the Hurricanes or the Sixers, so we'll get to that game in just a moment. But the Hurricanes are there because they knocked out the Stars in what was a weather-impacted game. Another match in the shortest version where we saw the umpires make every possible effort to get the game underway.
DB.
Where were these guys?
That was wild.
Where were these guys after lunch on day one in Sydney? Like, during the test
when it
match?
When there was like, man, a rain fell in 4 hours and we all sat there twiddling.
What they would have given for those conditions steady down in Hobart the other night.
Oh, my goodness. That was as bad condition-wise as I've probably seen. And I don't know, if it wasn't a final, I don't think that would have played.
No. I tend to agree with you. It felt like a what might have been night for the Melbourne Stars, and I know they've got one of the best coaches in world cricket in Peter Moores, but there were a number of decisions where you were sort of left scratching your head, and he came out really in the aftermath and said almost immediately, I think we made the right calls. I mean, they'll be debated around the water coolers, I'm sure we'll do here. why the Stars didn't let Maxwell and Stoinis face more balls than what they did. So they still sort of kept them in the middle order. In the end, they retired the player of the tournament in Sam Harper to get Maxwell out of there. He faced only four balls and didn't face a single ball in the final over when the game was on the line. Was it a missed opportunity by the Stars?
Well, you can only say yes, and hindsight's a beautiful thing when you're judging decisions like this.
Was this in hindsight, though? Like, weren't you thinking watching it at the time?
When the player of the yes and no. So where there are two sides to this coin. One side says, this guy's the player of the tournament. He's the form player. He will find a way. Great batters find ways in all conditions, in all formats to get it done. And so let's give him the first crack. I think the error is not moving fast enough, not ripping the Band-Aid off and saying, this actually isn't his night. We gave him a chance. We did the right thing. And so after five overs or whatever the number is, we're going to move through this pretty quickly and we're going to be ruthless.
But if you're going to do that with Harper, that's fine. But what about Tom Rogers and Joe Clark and these kind of guys? Yeah. Like, would we really have lost anything if Maxwell opened with Harper and then Stoinis came in at three and then all of a sudden we're telling a different story today?
I think you're right. And that's kind of the other side of the coin that I was just about to put forward is you have two world-class cricketers who know how to get it done in the shortest format, who are the most powerful, destructive players in the world or in that band. And so I want them facing as many of the 60 balls as possible. And so at least roll the dice with one of them and, you know, keep the other as flexibility. So to answer the question, I think they missed a trick.
Yep. And on a night where it found that the boundary was hard to find for large periods, Cartwright came in, struck from ball one. And then in the latter stages of the Hurricanes innings, when you're sort of thinking, who's going to bowl the last over? And it was hard to get underneath them and particularly to the short boundaries. They bowled Tom Curran. He went the journey. And in the end, I think Webster was able to find the boundary three times or put it over the fence three times. And in the end, what turned out to be a handy little cameo in that that final over decided the game. It was a match that basically another two runs and we got a super over. And who knows? Who knows at that point? It felt like tactically they missed a trick, the Melbourne Stars.
Yeah, and it comes down to something I touched on with the Scorchers, and that is a culture of finding ways to win. This is a team that has never really produced under any kind of pressure or the ability to call on something special when they need it at the right point in a season. Compared to the Hurricanes, who are the defending champions and have found ways to win from all kinds of places, kind of bar that little hiccup against the Heat. So, you know, when the pressure's on, you can't undercount confidence of knowing how to win a game. And the Hurricanes have it. The Sixers have it, particularly when Smith and Stark are around. And the Scorchers live and breathe that. Yep. So I think we're down to the three best teams.
And the Stars don't,
Does the Big Bash have an issue that here we are, the Scorchers and the Sixers, the two teams that have dominated this competition and the defending champions of the last three standing? I don't know. Do we want more jeopardy? Do we want less jeopardy?
Mm. It's a good question. I mean, they've tried with equalisation models in the past, sort of here and there, haven't they? But you know, whether they tip a few more resources in the favour of the struggling teams when it comes to the draft or whatever it turns out to be. But as you just highlighted with the Scorchers, it's also you got to have the right strategy. It's not just go and get the best free agent out there on the market and throw it at the wall and hope that it sticks. I mean, at a certain point, it's you got to be able to build the whole program, which is I think something that these three teams have in common, don't they? They have a certain culture. They have a great identity. It's sort of there's a reason they're back year after year, and for the Thunder, for teams like particularly the Renegades and the Thunder, who have sort of found themselves towards the bottom of the table for a period of time, that's what they got to try and build.
Yeah, I think you're right.
The Hurricanes, by the way, haven't played a single game at the SCG since December 2022. A weird quirk of the fixture. If they'd played the Melbourne Stars, the Stars have played there four times in that particular period. So just weird the way that the fixture comes together now that we don't play every team twice. Who wins tonight? Who plays Perth in the final on Sunday, Teddy?
Ooh, you're a brave man to bet against Steve Smith, basically. And that's what it comes down to. If Steve Smith scores runs, the Sixers win this game easily. The one thing against them is they've had a pretty cruel flight schedule, you know, between Sydney for the Derby to Brisbane to Perth back to Sydney. But if Smith fires, they win, full stop. If he doesn't, I think the Hurricanes win.
Yep. It's whatever we get, we're going to have a fun couple of games, I think for sure. I mean, if Steve Smith can just get one guy to play with him, they might be half a chance, the Sydney Sixers. If they had a single other player that had any kind of score of substance, they would have beaten Perth the other night. I mean, it's just...
But not even score of substance. Just stay out there and not... So the pressure was actually on Smith because the wickets were falling. No one needed to do anything. And so all they needed to do was bat, get the bloke on strike and watch him win the game single-handedly. And they couldn't do that. They had a total capitulation, had very little cricket sense or skill to deliver on that. And eventually, you know, it was too much for Steve Smith to do.
For a mature team, it was a pretty immature batting display.
Well, perfect. That is the perfect description.
David Warner, speaking of maturity, he's going to play on past 40, so he's recommitted to the Sydney Thunder for another season. Why not? He was the BBL's leading run scorer. He was the captain of the team of the tournament. It's hard to say there's no room for him in the BBL next year, Teddy.
Oh, and they're the names that we've got to maintain playing in the competition for long periods of time. His batting was exceptional. Again, no insight or aside from, you know, what I saw with my own eyes, and that is, I think his captaincy suffered from not being in around the group that much. I think it felt like he was, you know, commentating a lot this summer. You know, it was a big summer. There was lots of extra periphery stuff. Didn't affect his personal batting, but I do think the Thunder suffered because he wasn't there as a connector for a team that probably needs some connection.
Yeah, I mean, if he plays and he's not the captain, does that really matter? I mean, I don't know.
I think he wants.
My
gut feel is he likes that.
Gotcha. Yeah,
and I think the club should require more of him.
Tournament's rating well, so I can say that for sure. It's holding its own and beating the tennis on occasions as well on a game-by-game basis. So that's good news because it wasn't too long in the past that the tennis used to beat it most nights during the Australian Open. So it's been a very successful season on that front. Todd Greenberg, the boss of Cricket Australia, did an interview with our friends at TGC, which was a wide-ranging chat. Went for 55 minutes. There was a fair bit in it. I know you listened to it, Teddy. Where did your ears prick up? I'm sure we both took sort of different parts out of this, but what did you hear?
I loved the TGC podcast. I thought they did a great job. And, you know, a few things kind of spring up straight away. Todd Greenberg is as personable and as well-trained to deliver in that, you know, forum as any sports executive probably, definitely in Australia, if not the world. It's entertaining because he has an ability to laugh. He has ability to be self-deprecating, share stories, and work his way in, through, and mostly around answers or questions. I think cricket needs that kind of personality. So that's a big plus. A few things caught my ear, though, from a strategic point of view, and I don't know if they're the same things that you've put on your agenda. His comments in regards to gambling and cricket's revenue in and around that stream, I don't know if it's worth you kind of diving into.
So he said, basically, CA considers itself less in bed with the wagering partners than other organisations. In the short to media term, he can see them pulling back even further. He said, I can see that coming, certainly from a legislative position as well. Cricket has chosen not to participate in parts that it could generate more revenue from, talking about, you know, partnerships with with the gambling agencies. Went on to say that people will bet on it regardless of our position, so we don't want to be getting ripped off, but we're nowhere near reliant on it at the same level as some of the other domestic sports in this country, and that the legislative changes will impact other sports more than it will cricket. Does that sum it up a little bit on what he had to say on that front?
Yeah, I think that's... Thanks for providing the quotes. So, and you and I, yeah, I think it's worth kind of saying, see wagering very differently. I would say... I don't mind people, having the freedom of choice to gamble on whatever they wish, as long as there's decent guardrails around that. I don't love kids being exposed to it, but I believe that, you know, adults can make reasonable decisions. It does destroy lives, but you know, so does cigarettes, so does alcohol, so does pick your poison. So that's my starting point, and you can give your position in a second. The thing that caught my ear a little bit was, at the moment, cricket is kind of half pregnant with gambling, and that is, there's a major wagering partner, I won't provide the name, that pays a certain amount of money that I would estimate, and again, I don't know an exact figure, I reckon is probably 1/5, maybe more, of what cricket could be earning out of gambling. So, and that, I don't know, let's pick a number. Let's call it somewhere between $30 and $60 million short of what they could be earning. And so I sit here and say, we're going to potentially sell the Big Bash. We can't fund country cricket or indoor cricket because we have a hole in the balance sheet. Cricket is losing money. And so either one or two things happen. You either say, we are going to, this is my view, by the way, personal view.
Yep.
You either say, we're going to be a clean sport. We don't believe gambling is healthy, and we're going to not wean ourselves off. We're going cold turkey, and we're going to attract sponsors that believe in this vision of a wagering free sport. And you work your way around that. Or you go the other way and say, we're going to bleed this thing dry, and we've got an extra $50 million, let's say, a year to spend on grassroots cricket, and everything's a trade-off. So you can come at us and say, well, wagering's unhealthy, but my goodness, does it fund some grassroots cricket? My goodness, does it fund country cricket, whatever that is,
yep.
And there's a trade-off, and you're willing to make that. At the moment, we have a wagering partner who doesn't provide the money they should, because we've kind of got this half-baked attitude of legislation's coming, we'll take a little bit, it'll be easy to wean ourselves off. Well, we should either be black or white. At the moment, we're kind of stuck in the middle.
I actually think that's a great interpretation of it. As you said, we probably come at it from slightly different positions. I work in the media, obviously, every day, so you don't have to be twirling your moustache to think, you know, what you're incentivized by and everything else, and what comes into it. I feel like if you were to take a lot of the gambling revenue out of the media in particular, it would submarine, you know, large portions of the media. I mean, that's just a reality of what it is. And you're right. I mean, if you're going to take the money, you have to be prepared that, you know, in times with a family sitting down watching, you know, sport, there's going to be gambling ads on. That's just inescapable. You can't take all the money and then basically say, hey, by the way, your advertising's behind a paywall, or it's, you know, hidden here, or whatever it turns out to be. It's either one or the other. But I tend to agree with you on that front, that if you're going to see it and it is going to be present, you may as well be getting the most bang for your buck out of it, as opposed to, which is clearly what the AFL and the NRL are doing, that they don't make any apologies for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it funds their game to a large degree. And I guess where I get to is, at the moment, we're making trade-off, or having conversations to make trade-offs, that I think are probably less digestible than having gambling ads thrown at you during cricket. And that is an overseas billionaire owning the Sydney Sixers, for instance. You know, are there ways and means that we can fund our game that don't mean that we're selling either our souls or, you know, the future income streams that, you know, won't be seen at grassroots cricket?
And at the end of the day, everyone's got a price, don't they? I mean, we've lived through it with LIV Golf, for example, and you know, the Saudi involvement in sport and everything else. And even, you know, Todd was very careful to choose his words there when he was talking about the relationship with, you know, the PIF and everything else, and what it looks like going forward. So I think that's where my pushback comes when it comes to, you know, talk about wagering. I think it's easier for everyone to say, basically, oh, we shouldn't do it, it ruins lives, everything else. Well, yeah, think about the relationship we have in Australia with alcohol, for example, and how that is, and the addictive properties that are in alcohol compared to a lot of other things. And yeah, there's been plenty of money poured into the game, and you know, it's ever present at, you know, sporting events and advertising and all the rest of it for a period of time. I struggle to see the differences there.
Do you think it's the history? I don't know the answer as to this philosophical reasoning, you know, that Todd and the board have kind of taken. Do you think it's baked into the history of the game and the, you know, the betting scandals that have kind of been riddled throughout time as it relates to cricket?
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, you know how these things work. There's a chance that there could just be one person behind the boardroom that's like dead against it. Like it's their personal thing that they hate it, and so they speak up against it, and basically they sit around and they go, you know what, let's do it on a, if we're going to do it, let's do it minimally. as opposed to making it stand out or whatever it turns out to be. But as you said, you end up in this situation where you think, well, we're not doing one or the other here. We either need to make a call. And by the way, I have endless amounts of respect for administrators that not only govern teams successfully, but they take a principled stand along the way. I mean, I always talk about a guy named Nick Marvin, who was the managing director of the Perth Wildcats, and he took them from basically your equivalent of a high school gym out in Challenge Stadium to playing at Perth Arena, and they went from 5,000 seats to 13,000. And as they were doing that, they did away with their betting partner, they did away with all fast food sponsors, and they basically got money out of the government in anti-gambling, messaging and healthways and all these different types of partners that they could get, and they'd never been a bigger business. They sold out 13,000 in the middle of Perth Arena, and they were bigger than essentially the whole competition at that particular time. So that there's a way to do it if you want to take a principled stand, but it probably involves a lot of hard work. You got to go out there and shake a lot of hands and speak to a lot of businesses and eventually, like the Wildcats model was, hey, this might hurt us in the short term, but in the medium to long term, we're going to market ourselves to middle Australia and families, and they can bring their kids along and all the rest of it. And so it's, if you want to do that, you can, but it's a lot harder.
And that was the point that I was trying to make, and that's kind of where I gravitate to. I think there would be a long list of sponsors in corporate Australia that would fill that hole, probably not to the same degree that gambling sponsorship can provide, but certainly more than what we're earning out of gambling right now. So you're better off taking the principal approach potentially and saying, let's call it 10 million for the sake of the maths. We think we can make it 20 by just saying we are an anti-gambling sport. I don't know. And people are going to bet on cricket.
Yep.
Rain, hail or shine. So it's just a principle for or against, and you need to pick a side.
And then what do you get in the long run out of, how do you measure that as to, whether you make yourself more appealing for families and all the rest of it? He wouldn't be pressed on the scheduling. Sam asked him about 4 to 5 different times, I reckon, about what happens with the Big Bash and how we all fit in the same window and everything else. And he sort of spoke all the way around it, but said everything, then actually answered the question as it was put to him. Clearly they can't coexist in the same window. He was asked about the brands, which we spoke about last week, about what happens if all of a sudden one of the teams are renamed the Perth Scorchers or whatever, become the Super Giants or whatever it turns out to be. And he essentially said, I feel like there's a stronger connection with our brands than there have been in the 100 for the fact that it's gone for 15 years compared to 2 years. And so basically said, I hope that the prospective buyers appreciate that, but I don't think he went as far as to essentially say, no, it won't happen. Is that fair?
Well, hang on. If someone owns an asset, they can do basically what they want. If there is an agreement in place and they control the voting, I imagine if this goes ahead, that states will have an option. If you want to sell more than 51%, you're giving up control around X, Y, and Z, and like it or lump it. And so it's not a question of whether you can or you can't.
Yeah. Some attitude that permeates right throughout the organization, which certainly caused my ears to prick up as I was trotting around yesterday listening to it. The justification of the results, basically silences any other criticism that it's, hey, the team's doing well. So if there's any other criticism of the selectors or anything that goes on in Australian cricket, how could you possibly say that? Have a look at what the output is on the field. And to hear the CEO say it, having heard that, behind the scenes from so many people, basically, how could you possibly be critical of anyone? Look at what they've done. It feels like that's running through Cricket Australia at the moment. And I just caution on the fact that it's not too far in the past, and it's going to come around again when the team visits South Africa at the end of the year, that we had that attitude for a long period of time that winning covers all sins, and it speaks to basically what happened there, that past is prologue, that winning's one thing, yes, but there is a certain expectation from the cricket community that the team conducts itself in a certain way. And Todd was quite flippant. He laughed off the Stuart Clark comments or whatever, and I get that they have a relationship, but also the part that was attached to that was the fact that they barred the ABC under his administration from basically doing an interview at the end of the day's play because they didn't like the criticism that was coming towards the team. I just worry that it's a dangerous path to head down. And even after that, I spoke to people behind the scenes and they basically said, look, we're comfortable with how we handled it. That's fine. But the blowback was strong from people basically saying, hey, we don't like the way this team conducts themselves and the way that had unfolded. And I worry that either they're lying to me, which I hope that's the case, and that they've probably reconsidered that internally, Or two, they're not listening to the general public, and they're basically saying, hey, we don't care what you say, we're winning, you're coming, your bums are on the seats, we're happy with that, we couldn't care less whether you're happy with the way that we conduct ourselves or not.
Yeah, look, I hear what you're saying, and I'll take a different twist because I don't necessarily agree with everything word for word. And that is, I think in a banner series like the Ashes, you know, results matter because it is historically a bit of a bellwether series for the direction of what happens next. Because if you lose an Ashes at home, the CEO loses his job, the coach loses his job, often the captain loses their job. And so to get through the series and to win as comfortably as they did, I think gives them some confidence. Where I probably diverge, I think the public is proud of this team and how they conduct themselves. That isn't the same as how the organisation conducts themselves, for the record. But I think as a team, I think people are proud to support them. The thing that comes to mind when you start talking about this topic specifically is actually the legacy, and we've talked about this before, that this team leaves. And if that legacy is one of ongoing success, then I think we can look back and say, you know what? We were wrong. They were right. But all roads aren't leading there at the moment. This is a team that is aging rapidly. This is a team that, you know, is struggling for depth outside, you know, some core players. And so when you look at what is around the corner, it feels like from the outside in, there is a cliff approaching and everyone's saying, look out for the cliff. And they're saying, don't worry, this car's going so fast, it's going to jump the cliff. You just got to trust us. You got to trust us. But eventually you got to be shown. And so I think there's a little bit of a disconnect between the public's, or you know, my view or your view or whoever's view that is, as to where this is headed, and a little bit of false confidence, which we hate, as to what potentially could happen.
I feel a little bit, though, that it's, you know, when I talk about the fact that they're not listening to people from the outside, it's not so much that they have a different view. It's the fact that, hey, if you have a different view than us, we are actually actively going to go out of our way to silence that as best that we can. We don't like questions about it. We're not going to take them on board. Like, I mean, I haven't interviewed George Bailey or Andrew McDonald since that episode about Nathan McSweeney. And essentially, I've got text messages on my phone saying, hey, if you don't say nice things, that they won't, you know, these people aren't going to want to chat to you. And essentially, it's been 14 months now, and that's been the case. So you got to remember the people that are posing these questions and that are strong about it. You know, who, at the end of the day, who cares what I say? I'm just a member of the media. But the general public feels that way, and they feel that way largely because they hear from people like you and former players at test level. I mean, these are guys that are, you know, former greats of the game, and there is clearly a disconnect at the moment between the team and the cricket fraternity. And I think to say, hey, you know, winning covers all sins, don't worry about it, we're great, yeah, everything's gravy. I don't know what, I mean, you walk around the media centre and you speak to a bunch of, you know, former players and how they feel about the current team. And I think to ignore that and not to actually address that in any kind of way, and I know they made a move in Adelaide to at least get some of the former players in to have a beer with the team after the Ashes had been retained, I think there needs to be a little bit more done to bridge that gap when you've got some of the comments that you've got from former players and, you know, calling for assistants to be sacked and everything else.
I definitely agree. I think we can agree on that. And I think I've said before, I don't think the bubble has ever been so big and so thick around an Australian cricket team for whatever reason. I don't know those reasons, but you can definitely feel that.
Yeah.
After
Cape Town, there was a review which talked about, you know, the gilded bubble and, you know, the Argus review and everything else. So, and now you're saying, well, we've never had a bigger bubble.
Yeah. So it's going to take some time to work through that and see where it kind of lands. So I kind of hear you. Let's see.
Yeah.
I guess.
But I think it'd be silly to say, hey, that's just, you know, the sports guy's opinion or whatever. I think that there's lots of former players.
I agree with that.
Bangladesh. So one thing that the Cricket Australia has done is they voted in favour of the ICC when it comes to Bangladesh. So it went to a vote around the ICC board members, came back 14-2. So Bangladesh and Pakistan voted in the favour of Bangladesh wanting to move their games away from India. And the rest of the 14 votes went the way of the ICC and essentially cricket to say, nope, it's too late. Security concerns that you cite aren't realistic. You'll be safe. job's on. You need to go to India and play in these games. And if you don't, the reports are that Scotland will take their place in the tournament.
I mean, no surprises here, really. And it talks to, you know, the politicking that happens at the ICC the whole time. You know, the fact that it's, what are we, 2 weeks before, 3 weeks before the tournament, and a vote's happening now and not a year ago, it just gives the buffer of it's too close to the tournament. These kind of issues should have been ironed out 12 months ago, realistically.
But if an issue comes up on short notice when it comes to security, what does it matter whether it's 2 days out or 10 days out?
Like, I agree with that. I don't know what the security situation is. I just can't comment on that.
Yeah. Well, it'll be... I mean, the obvious question here is, you know, if it was another nation in that position, would it be handled the same way? You know, are Bangladesh more disposable given the fact that, you know, they're not a cricketing powerhouse? And
without doubt.
Yep.
And they're aligned to Pakistan and Pakistan. You know, like,
haves and have not.
This is a real case of politics.
Yep.
And not just cricket politics, for the record.
Yeah, correct. Which is, I mean, the broader issue is it's a problem for sport and for cricket in general if all of a sudden nations basically start saying, based off, you know, political tensions, hey, we're not going there, we're not going there, and so on and so forth. And people will point back to, well, you know, India don't go to Pakistan and vice versa. And they'll say, well, that's actually a very real security concern about the teams changing and obviously the government control and all the rest of it. But that's often been a thing that we've kind of just said, look, that's just for India and Pakistan to work out. And now we've got a third country involved in that. What happens if it's a fourth country and a fifth country? There's only 10 countries or whatever that play cricket. All of a sudden, three of them are not going to visit anywhere. It's starting to become a bit of a concern. Just on the T20 landscape ahead of the World Cup, so Abhishek Sharma went off again last night, scored 84 off 35 balls. This guy is, I think, probably the best batsman in T20 cricket at the moment. It's pretty hard to make the case that he's not. India won again, and as good as the Australian team's been, India's record since the last World Cup is 30 wins and 5 losses. They're 30 and 5 since the last World Cup, which they won, by the way. And now they're carrying the most imposing record into a home tournament. So you'd be hard-pressed to say that that India are not the favourites as much as I think we're both pretty bullish about the Aussies' chances.
Yeah, we're one good game away, really. If Australia play good cricket on the day, it will be good enough to beat India. It's a question whether they bring that. There's only one team, I think, that can beat India in India under pressure, and that's Australia. We'll see.
Dominoes are falling for England. They lost their game last night against Sri Lanka to start their best of three T20 ODI series, a 19-run defeat to Sri Lanka. They were cruising, one for 129, chasing 270, and were all out for 250. Chief selector Luke Wright announced his resignation, so he's had 3 years in the gig. He'll finish up at the end of the T20 World Cup. Troy Cooley's back in the coaching setup as the pace bowling lead at England, and the review continues into off-field personnel, which includes Key and McCullum. So watch this space on England.
Yeah. One other topic that we need to cover before we go.
It's not the trophy from that ODI tournament. Have you seen that?
It's not the trophy from the ODI tournament. It is, did you catch the big release around the Euro T20 League?
Remember, mighty Amsterdam Flames.
The Amsterdam Flames.
I love that they're the Flames, by the way.
As invested by Australian hockey great Jamie Dwyer. As though poor Andre van Troost, or, you know, someone who actually has some connection to cricket in the Netherlands.
The Flames.
I mean, I have no conviction that any of those teams, people have, like, actually put in money for this. They're all getting zero. Like, there is no world in which that is a successful league. No world, unfortunately. In a landscape that's dominated by media rights, that is, having played cricket in Scotland a lot and Holland, and so we're covering two of the four teams. These are niche sports, and so, yes, forget the minimal revenue that you can get from bums on seats. It's TV audience, and if that's not a local TV audience, which it's not going to be, it's got to be an international audience, and they rely on the best players, and they cost big money, and so, you know, this is going to be a suck. And unless you have Indian players, the Indians aren't interested. Otherwise, it becomes a betting league.
I was about to say, that's where the money's coming from.
I know, but that, and then, you know, that it's sanctioned by the ICC. It's very quick. There's one little indiscrepancy around that, and you're out. You then are some kind of unsanctioned league that has big issues. So look, I love the shiny new toy that people get excited for, but as my friend who was on the text line asking about it said, they should all just buy some more racehorses and take the punt there, because this ain't going anywhere.
Wow, that's a strong call to basically say, hey, the thing's not even off the ground yet, and yet you don't believe in Dublin versus Belfast or Edinburgh and Glasgow and Amsterdam and Rotterdam and all these famous cricketing markets that they're going to be able to get this thing up and going?
I don't think it's that much of a contrarian view to think they're absolutely ridiculous. Look, I love cricket in those. I'm all for spreading cricket, and good on them for having a go. But a private league where you're raising money at a valuation, by all means, you need some benefactors, but it's a donation. So don't try and make it a business. Maybe it can be a business in the future, but there is so much risk involved in getting this off the ground. They actually, I just don't think they've done it the right way.
They've already got Steve Smith and Mitch Marsh, along with Scott Edwards, who's the captain of the Dutch. He's played a fair bit of cricket in Australia. They're all playing for Amsterdam, which is Steve Waugh's team. League is sanctioned by the cricket boards of Ireland, Scotland and the Netherlands. It'll run from August 26 to September 20. So look out for that. Glenn Maxwell is also an investor in a franchise over there as well. So, you wouldn't be putting your money in, Teddy, if they came to you and said, hey, do you want to invest in Belfast or whatever?
Not a dollar.
No. All right. Well, we'll see how it goes. What's the motivation then for someone like Steve Waugh to be involved in it?
I don't know. I actually struggle to kind of understand. I think there's a world where, you know, as I said, T20 franchises are very shiny and attractive, generally in the right leagues as an asset. But, you know, I think if you put an institutional lens on it and try and understand the dynamics of what it actually is, I think you'd be hard-pressed to try and work through that.
Little three cheers for Will Melichuk as well, who scored the fastest 100 in under-19s World Cup history off 51 balls. 8-wicket win first up over the mighty Japan for our Aussie boys.
The Japanese boys played pretty well. I actually watched the game because I was bored the other night. They had some solid technique. What did they get? They got 200 or something.
Yeah, they made 201.
Which was a bit of a concern. I thought, oh, goodness me. That's a tricky chase against a real minnow.
We got there in 21 overs.
Evidently been practicing their batting a bit more than their bowling.
The back of Will Melichuk's baseball card, so plays for Claremont as well in the WAFL through their footy program, had to make the choice between cricket and footy, and I think as we've seen in recent times, it's a good idea to at least start with cricket. Guys like Alex Keith and Will Parker and Zach Evans have all ended up on AFL lists after having a run in Australian cricket. He was named in WA's squad for an ODI, you know what I mean, one day domestic game in September, and trained with the test squad in Perth ahead of the Ashes opener. So right on to Will Melichuk. And hopefully we learn a few more about a couple of these other new names in the under-19 setup. They play Sri Lanka today to go top of Pool A, or Group A, whatever they're calling it over there at the World Cup. Good luck to the Aussie boys. I think they're good things in their title defence. Thanks to you, Teddy. I think that's a pretty good hit out for a Friday.
Good hit out. Yeah, good hit out. Yeah. Well done, Mr. Tennis.
I'm back to some forehands and some backhands, and I will see you on Monday when we've crowned a champion in the BBL. By then, one of the teams will have flown to Perth and be on the way home. So we'll pull it all apart on Monday.
Amazing. Can't wait.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.